Good morning. Dave Ward, Anglican priest, active duty Army chaplain currently at Fort Sam Houston at the Medical Professional Training Brigade, and will soon become a clinical pastoral education supervisor, which means that moving to Washington, D.C. to Walter Reed this summer. Beyond that, I've been a chaplain for about 15 years and deployed to Iraq. Back at the height of the war, 2007-2008, part of the surge, I was with a striker brigade. If you're not familiar with the striker, decided to bring a picture. That is $5 million each. They weigh 20 tons on I-5 between Yakima and Fort Lewis. They will go faster than 60 miles an hour, even though that's what they're rated as. Until you blow the turbo, and then you go really slow. That was what I was trained in and ready to deploy with. I was in the Reconnaissance, Surveillance, and Target Acquisition Squadron, which is what used to be the Cavalry Squadron, but they've changed that to make it so much more complicated. Various weapons on this vehicle. This was, to me, the Cadillac of military vehicles. It was amazingly maneuverable, fast, sleek. As far as military vehicles go, it was pretty sexy. And we got to Iraq, and they did that to it. Or, let's see, got a better picture there. They did that to it. And I'm like, what happened to that? You know? And so suddenly, I really felt like I was going to war with these guys. So, it did feel that way.
So we all know who that is.
I've got an audience old enough to know who that is. So from there, I went to the intelligence community, served as a chaplain to a battalion that had assets across, they call it assets, there's just soldiers, across Southwest Asia, so I got to travel a lot, and then ended up at the National Security Agency as the brigade chaplain to the Army unit that supports the NSA. Moved here to become a CPE, or Certified Pastoral Education Resident, at BAMC, where I spent a year working pretty much in the trauma unit there at BAMC. So that's me in a nutshell. Looking at the question of why moral injury matters, I kind of glossed over the fact that this is a presentation on moral injury, PTSD, and soul repair. This is actually a slide deck that comes from the Army. We as chaplains present this to other chaplains and other clergy, just to kind of bring awareness and define some things. We focus on moral injury as the chaplains, because PTSD, we'll get into that, is a psychological disorder. It's in the realm of psychologists. Whereas moral injury is spiritual injury, and that comes into our realm. So we focus, or I tend to focus more on that. So I have a couple of links to, okay, we'll exit show and go here.
Global Ethics Corner from the Carnegie Council.
As the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq wind on, there is a new idea about the damages of war, moral injury. Moral issues usually focused on rationales to fight, just the war, for instance, or on victims, and victims are found on all sides. Victims are the maimed, the dead, the ensnared civilians, and the crumbling of civilized behavior. Soldiers were survivors, heroes, or perpetrators, but rarely victims. Recently, with the recognition of mental damage suffered by combatants of post-traumatic stress syndrome, surviving soldiers became potential victims. Now, Walker reports that a group of mental health experts is giving a name to the guilt and remorse troops feel when they see or do bad things during war, moral injury. The issue is, How deeply does combat wound the minds of combatants? Many actions are morally ambiguous, and people also act against their values. Most have been haunted by a pledge unfilled, by a promised deed undone, by a failure to live up to their values. Everyone copes with moral injury. Religions sanctify life, command do not kill, and then sanction crusades or jihads. Combat, approved by legitimate authority, becomes morally defensible. Still, combat is distinctive, violent, intense, and under certain clearly defined conditions, soldiers are given licenses to kill. What do you think? Are combatants' experiences potentially more traumatic because of the horrors they face and the legitimacy they received? Or is the moral injury to soldiers simply a more extreme extension of the moral issues faced by everyone? This is William Vokey.
Made possible by the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs.
So, an introduction there to moral injury. Slide. There's another video associated with that, and it's a retired Army chaplain talking about the fact that in the history of warfare, and it's based on David Grossman's book on killing, and the fact that he goes back to the Civil War, and there's been an aversion in our soldiers throughout history to killing. That the mixed confused messages and just the thought of taking another person's life has been a struggle. And he goes back to Gettysburg, where they found muskets that had mini balls stuffed in them, where the soldiers were just going through the motions of the drill and not ever firing, because there was this inherent aversion to killing. And taking that to World War I, where it became the artillery, king of battle, that does most of the killing in World War II, and the transition in the last, between World War II and Vietnam, from targets, zero, circles with the center shot, to silhouettes, and how now we have soldiers that are getting trained with the sight aperture of the human form. And we were watching 12 Strong, and I don't know if you're familiar with that movie. And we'll watch Lone Survivor as well. There's a clip that we'll discuss. But you see the differences in fighting techniques, especially in 12 Strong, where you have American Green Berets fighting alongside Afghani warlords. And you see the Green Berets are firing two shots and then moving to the next target, and how quickly they're aiming. And I pointed out to my kids, you see the difference between this is the American soldiers are taught to aim at all costs, whereas these Afghanis that they're fighting alongside of are just kind of spraying and praying without actually aiming at targets. They're just in the general area. So it's kind of interesting the way how that has, the studies that have come to talk about the fact that American soldiers now are so trained and so ready, and once they deploy, they do their job and they do it efficiently, and then that later sinks in. And that's where some of the moral injury comes from. I wasn't really familiar with moral injury until a few years ago in the intelligence community, where a lot of guys sit in cubes and stare at screens, and they're doing the monitoring of a UAV feed on the other side of the planet. And the soldiers are coming to me with these PTSD-like symptoms. I'm like, you haven't been exposed to combat or trauma. How is it that you're demonstrating PT? And the initial is, dude, you sit in a cube all day and watch TV. How is it that you're having nightmares? And things like that. You've never been in a war zone. And from there, it became the realization that this, and I don't know, Jack Ryan, did we watch that? Yeah, it is kind of portrayed there in that series poorly, but this kid's watching a bad guy and following him all day on an 8-hour shift, and at the end of the shift, there may be a decision to fire a missile and destroy that target. And then the kid has to do the battle damage assessment, write up a report, and leaves work and goes over to the soccer field to watch his five-year-old play soccer. And how this is taking a toll, even though the person's never been in combat. And I thought about it. If you watched me on a Saturday morning, I went to Home Depot, I got some nails, and then I drove over to the gas station, but I didn't pay at the pump, so I went inside and have a contact there now. And then I went to Walmart and picked up a propane tank for my gas grill. And you build a narrative around that. And if you're thinking suspiciously of what I'm doing, suddenly that's a pretty suspicious pattern. And so there's some ambiguity in that. Now, it's a lot more detailed in what our intelligence community does. But I can see where someone would struggle with, what do I really know? And that becomes a difficult thing to process. And so that's where moral injury, I think, comes into play. What's up my slide? So a definition. The VA actually defined it. Moral injury is disruption in an individual's confidence and expectation about his or her own moral behavior or others' capacity to behave in a just and ethical manner. The lasting impact of moral injury in war remains chiefly unaddressed. We're still trying to figure out what to do with this. So I went to Wiki because that's where I get all my good material for my sermons, for pretty much everything, and looked for a definition I could understand is what I was going with, because that VA definition is a little unsatisfying. Moral injury refers to an injury to an individual's moral conscience resulting from an act of perceived moral transgression which produces profound emotional shame. The concept of moral injury emphasizes the psychological, social, cultural, and spiritual aspect of trauma. Distinct from pathology, moral injury is a normal response to an abnormal traumatic event. It goes on with, moral injury can also be experienced by those who have been transgressed against. For example, this is from the Wiki article. When one goes to war believing that the purpose of the war is to eradicate weapons of mass destruction, but finds that not to be the case, a warrior can experience moral injury due to a sense of betrayal by the leadership. Thus, those who have seen or experienced death, mayhem, destruction, violence, and have had their worldviews shattered, the sanctity of life, safety, love, health, peace, etc., can also suffer moral injury. There are other definitions. Moral injury is the damage done to one's conscience or moral compass when that person perpetrates, witnesses, or fails to prevent acts that transgress their own moral or ethical values, code of conduct. Moral injury is the inability to contextualize or justify personal actions or actions against others and the unsuccessful accommodation of these experiences into pre-existing moral schemes. So the pre-existing moral scheme, the code of ethic that I live by, thou shalt not kill for the soldier, suddenly that has been changed. I personally like this one that I found for a definition by some old sage. A deep soul wound that pierces a person's identity, sense of morality, and the relationship they have to society. And I think that's pretty well summed up, I think, moral injury is all about. So, go back to the Odysseus and the Trojan Wars, and when you read those in light of what we understand moral injury and post-traumatic stress, you see where even the Greeks kind of knew. So when we talk about this as ancient, the Greeks understood this concept that people are changed and are affected by war. And it's ongoing. Some of the interesting things about moral injury, PTSD is very associated with the timeline. Once you have a traumatic event and the post-traumatic stress of that event, because there's traumatic stress. Probably all experienced that at some point. There's post-traumatic stress, and then there's post-traumatic stress that people can't overcome. And that, at that point, it becomes a disorder. Whereas moral injury comes into play, there isn't really a timeline associated with it. It could be 10 years afterwards where somebody realizes and it's haunted by something, and they have to reevaluate when they re-question. Because we're asking young kids, 19-year-olds, to go to a combat zone where there's a completely different moral and ethical code. And they go and they do their job and they function by that code, and then they come back here. And then they reevaluate everything they did by the code that they had for the first 18 years, and now they have trying to reestablish the code and live within this code, and now everything is being judged by a morality that, truthfully, war is pretty immoral. As just as we might think the causes might be for a war, the actual acts of war aren't necessarily moral. And so we're asking people to come back and judge them, and they feel judged, and they feel shame. And that's kind of the idea behind moral injury. There was another thought in there. There was that bunny, and I'm like, oh, that was a good bunny, though. I'm going to chase that rabbit, but I can't remember what the rabbit even looked like right now. So any thoughts or any questions? Yes, sir.
I have two. Your slide up there said 18 veterans a day commit suicide.
Yes, sir.
I was at the Veterans Hospital, Holly Mercury, a few weeks ago, visiting a vet. They've been in Iraq 3 or 4 times in his career. Mm-hmm. And it says 22 to 23 a day are dying now. Is that just in the San Antonio area, or is that nationwide?
I believe that's nationwide.
They had these posters on more than one floor. That's what caught my attention.
And that statistic, I don't know when that slide was when that was taken. And I know at one point the active duty side of the suicidality and the active duty was really, really high. I don't know that it was 18 a day, but places like Fort Campbell in 2009, 2010, we're seeing 20 a year, which, you know, for a population of a military base, it's pretty high by per capita, however that statistic works. I saw a slide that it was like worldwide 50 people a second or something insane. It's just the way the shift has changed things. So some examples of moral injury, using deadly force and causing harm or deaths to civilians, knowingly, but without an alternative, or accidentally. I think of we had a situation where we watched this group of people go out, set up a mortar tube, and shoot into one of our remote bases where my soldiers were at. And the UAV pilot, who's at Creech Air Force Base, right? Right? Is that where they're at? That's okay. And he's there, and he's flying, and he's watching, and he comes on the line and says, hey, those are 2 adults and 3 kids. And what do you do? And so therein lies a perfect example of what's the alternative. And that commander, who is, you know, a captain in the Army, is, what, maybe 26 years old, leading 19-year-olds? And he's got those 19-year-olds, and those are his kids, and he doesn't want them to die from some mortar attack. So he's got a moral, ethical dilemma. So, yeah, giving orders that can cause the death or injury to fellow service members. We had a general officer that I talked to who, at echelons above, felt directly responsible for the death of these kids in a squad. So the Army goes squad, platoon, company, battalion, brigade, division. This is a division commander who feels directly responsible because he ordered the operation and this squad that lost soldiers. And I thought, there's that moral injury. Failure to provide. It's kind of the sentence, and I think maybe, I'm not sure if it was in my notes, or if there's the transgression, there's the what we have done, and then there's like the what we've left undone. That can be morally injurious. And following the rules of engagement, and they're there, and you can follow those rules to a T, and still somebody gets shot that is a civilian on the battlefield. And that can lead to that moral injury. So a lot of people like to look at moral injury as a reaction of conscience. It requires a healthy prefrontal cortex. So this is where happiness is. Science alert, right? I'm not a neurologist. And if anyone who's present is a neurologist, perhaps after we get to these next couple of slides, you can explain everything that I just tried to explain. So one of the other things. So we'll look at this, but when somebody experiences a mild traumatic brain injury, where the actual physical noggin is concussed, and is what we look for now, can somebody in those times, and you layer the complicatedness of this, somebody who has a legitimate brain injury, mild as it may be, and now we've damaged this place where our emotions are processed. And then we are doing things like, do we shoot the group of kids who've shot mortars as a... So you really get into a very complex problem. So that front part of our brain is where we regulate our behaviors. And it includes meditating those conflicting thoughts and the choices between right and wrong. And so somebody has an MTBI or mild traumatic brain injury, and they're in a combat zone and they're doing things. And then once that heals, now suddenly we have another set of problems. So if you can imagine all of the sensory overload that goes on in a firefight or whatever combat situation, and then we have those various acts of omission or commission, and that just sets the stage for this problem.
And a lot of times those events happen together.
Say again?
A lot of times those events happen together.
Yes, and they happen simultaneously. And so there's also a component of this, of the betrayal of one's own values, morals, virtues, ethics, that you've done something that you've betrayed your own sense of right and wrong. Or as a group, because you look at, you look at these teams, and those teams have their own identity, and they have their own ethic, and they have their own value system as an organization, and perhaps the organization does something that is against its own value system. And so there's always that sense of, in many ways with moral injuries, that sense of betrayal that leads to that sense of shame. Because moral injury is about shame. And we're going to talk about PTSD. PTSD is a fear response. So, yeah, PTSD and moral injury. PTSD is a fear victim response in extreme conditions. And it actually, there's some rewiring that happens. Again, science alert, I'm not a neurologist. But traumatic stress, and if you take out the post and you take out the disorder, the event itself, the exposure to traumatic events, rewires our brain software, if that makes sense. So you have the amygdala, and I like to keep it simple, so we just call her Amy. So Amy is your crazy ex-girlfriend, by the way. Amy governs emotions surrounding the response to the stimuli. In this little slide here, we have the stimulus. This is fight. This is flight. This is freeze. This is fear. This is anger. This is all that. And then we go to response. Well, Amy, in a traumatic situation, says, we don't need this down here. We don't need to go to the hippocampus that processes our memories and stores and files our memories so that we know how to react to this because of previous experience. Amy has taken that out. So literally in brain imagery, the post-traumatic stress victims, you see where their hippocampus has shrunk or reduced in size. And at the same time, Amy, so she's skipping hippie, call the hippocampus a hippie. And then also we have the prefrontal cortex, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex to be specific. And that is where our regulations of Amy takes place. Amy, again, she's the fight, flight response mechanism. And that prefrontal cortex is doing everything it can to reduce her influence on that emotional response. And so you have that situation where you've been exposed to trauma repeatedly and the amygdala is in charge. And that fight-flight response, and that she's there to keep you alive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I used to, my personal experience, and anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about myself, but anyway, I can talk about me because I'm subject matter expert on myself. So I think about it, 15 months. I talked to my dad about this because he was a Vietnam veteran. My dad's with 100 Missions over in North Vietnam back in the day in an F-4 Phantom. And so we were talking, and he had this realization that he couldn't relate to my combat experience, and I couldn't relate really to his. Because he did his mission up north, flew back to Thailand, went to the Oak Club, had dinner. I went and wandered around the FOB, where everywhere I walked for about 15 months, I'm looking for where to duck and cover. Because I'm under this sense of constant threat. We have this rocket attacks a lot, and so these things are happening. And Amy has been ruling for about 15 months. So we fast forward. I'm home. I'm in Fort Lewis, Washington. I'm standing out in my backyard by the grill, and an airliner flies over. And as it does this reverse engine thing or drops its landing gear or whatever it is. And I am now laying next to the grill because Amy is still running the show. And that lasted for about 6 months. And I finally told my wife, Deb, what's wrong with me? Why am I still so jumpy? And she's the one who said, hey, your body has wired itself for your preservation. And that's really cool to see that God actually designed it that way and that it works. And it's going to be okay. And it'll take time. Now, that was about the 6 month window. At around the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th month, if I'm still doing that, then it starts to become disorder. If that makes sense. So, yeah. So, PTSD, that's the consistency of the symptoms. There is we'll get into the next slide, but we have nightmares, we have dissociative episodes, panic attacks, hypervigilance. Lack of consciousness or memory or fragmented memory. So nightmares, the subconscious is replaying the events and changing them. You have the combat veteran who wakes up from a nightmare where he's being strafed by World War II era aircraft. What? But that's the way the whole situation, the subconscious is kind of playing with you and playing with the events. And the nightmares that I never really experienced nightmares, but I remember soldiers telling me that it's weird the way it happened in the dream.
Yeah.
And didn't happen that way in reality. So I would encourage soldiers, if you have an event, write down details, specific factual information, so that when your mind does that and you wake up and you're sweaty and it's a panic attack, you can actually have a written record of what really happened. And that helps kind of ground you back to reality. Mm-hmm. Dissociative disorders, those would be like flashbacks. Blanking out, unable to remember a specific block of time. Kind of a daydream that kind of runs amok. Hypervigilance, constantly on guard, doing duck and cover in the backyard, 6 months later, is that hypervigilance. People who maintain that obsessive awareness of their surroundings. We talk to a lot of veterans who say, I don't like sitting with the back to the door. That's still part of that hypervigilance. And also, one of the things we've seen is overtraining, where people who have deployed have had these traumatic experiences and they're dealing with it and they come back and they're going to train the next generation and they're going to not go through any of the experiences that I went through because I'm going to have them so well trained that, nothing bad will happen to them. And again, that's like hypervigilance. And then lack of conscious commitment, that's kind of dissociative disorders there.
Nightmares, if they need, when they wake up, they need to be grounded again. Do they add things to, their mind? Are they adding elements to the initial trauma, that they've gotten through these nightmares?
I'm not sure how that actually works. I know people know us know Faith. So when I was deployed, Faith was about 4, and we had a mass cal event that involved civilians and mostly children, and we had this little girl, Iraqi girl, she was brought in, and she not survived. We wrapped her up inside her side, waiting for the parents. That night, well, 2 nights later, the dream was that the little girl who was wrapped up had on Faith's sandals.
Hey, you dropped your voice.
I had on Faith's sandals, my little girl's sandals. Mm-hmm. And I woke up saying, no, that is not, we're not going there, brain.
Yeah.
We're not doing that. Don't even try. And that was kind of that realization of, no, that wasn't that way that worked out. And I don't know why brain did that. But
I could see how it could be.
Right.
And just...
Right. But yeah, and as I said, she's crazy ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
So she's doing weird things.
Yeah.
So the uniqueness of the situation, PTSD involves multiple events over an extended period of time, a deployment cycle. But then it actually, there's a certain timeline that's associated with the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. If you are not coming out of it after a year, and you're still doing the dissociative flashbacks, and those can last for a lifetime. Nightmares can last for a lifetime, panic attacks, all these things. There's a time where you reintegrate and you come back and it's no longer post-traumatic stress. It's post-traumatic stress, it's just not the disorder aspect of it. Both of them though, you see where the stressors tightly closed system, so actions are considered immoral in other contexts, they're sanctioned and even celebrated within the rules of engagement. So you have what is considered immoral, killing over here. We don't do that in the United States. We go over there, we celebrate, and woohoo, so it's a very weird thing that can happen for both. And then one of the things that I've read about and it requires abrupt transition from one system to another, we take in our society civilian and we send them to war and then we come back and expect them to be civilian again. And we go back and it's relatively a recent thing because I remember going home for R&R leave and thinking, wow, 24 hours ago I was in a combat zone, here I am in downtown Seattle. And the difficulty it was and how noisy and this is just kind of weird, the moment of having this realization of, wow, less than 36 hours ago people were trying to kill me, and now I'm surrounded by all these people and this transition, there's that aspect of it where I don't think we give enough time for people to make an adjustment. And it comes to my end of my deployment, my squadron commander made us go to Kuwait. We went from Iraq to Kuwait. We're all ready to go home. And he made us wait for 3 days to do some processing and as a chaplain, I was very involved with going around and talking to soldiers and doing briefings with soldiers. And then we went back, and I think that mitigated some of that difficulty of making the transition from not safe to kind of safe to safe. And I thought that was pretty wise. But if we go back to that civilian, combatant civilian that our society expects, go to previous generations, and they would take their civilian and make them and send them off to war in other cultures, you would see where that would come back, and they would transition to becoming a leader or a sage, or what wisdom did you learn from that experience? So that there was never an expectation that you would be back to civilian. And that's some of the readings that I've done talks about some of the other, I don't know, it's ancient cultures, but previous generations, where there wasn't that expectation that you would just return to civilian life. There was an expectation that you would bring wisdom to the community because you have seen and done things that others don't understand. And I think that's kind of what this line is talking about. It requires about transition from one system to another system with little support. And then women face... Yes.
So my question is for transitioning back from being in a war zone back to coming over stateside, what is the effect with the families? Like, I mean, a lot of these servicemen and women have families that come into that. Like, how do we locally minister to not just the person but to the family unit with that?
I think it's difficult for, I was, 38, 39 years old, been married for 15, 16 years. As a child, it was very different for me, but I looked at young kids, 19, 20, 21, 22, who were married for a couple of years, and the stressors that was. Even just having been married for such a short time, and then you add in the combat. And so I think the spouses need the support, not specifically what that looks like. Yes?
I went through and dealt with all of this, and education was the biggest help for my life.
Yeah.
And understanding that, and all the different things that education can bring, but understanding that I didn't come home the same person I left. Mm-hmm. I'm not ever going to be the same person I was. And is she okay with that? And how is she going to help me, whether she's okay with that or not, to move forward?
Right.
And
I think the Army had, especially back then when we had Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a lot of support mechanisms out there and a lot of information for spouses. That's kind of gone away because the things have wound down, if you will, even though we still have several thousand soldiers in harm's way.
Because I'm thinking about it from, you know, from a clergy perspective, it's always harder, I think, on the spouse.
Like, yeah.
You know, but I'm thinking the same thing with kind of like a similar thing with the PTSD that you have the service person going through a living hell, and then the spouse trying to deal with it.
And then you get into the divorce rate is astronomical because the spouse has done everything she can and is done with it. Women and face really difficult challenges in this situation and deal with their fears of sexual assault, isolation, stress, the stress to avoid the harassment and the assault, the lack of the fact that there aren't things specifically, and especially in combat zones, the gender stuff kind of gets negated, and it's hard for maintaining the gender specific stuff. So it becomes very challenging, I think, for women, and I think that they a remarkable service women that do deploy and do great things, but they got to put up with a lot that can lead to additional moral injury. We have time. Are we good? Okay. So we're looking at morally disrupting aspects of war. We do reflexive fires, reflexive fire training, and that is to get the soldiers' reflexes to pull that trigger very quickly, and then kind of overrides that thinking. Dehumanization of our enemy, that overrides our empathy, because they're no longer humans, they're whatever generation. If you go back, I think in World War II we called them krauts or various euphemisms that we use that I won't go down the road of because we're recording. But anyway, participation in atrocities overrides military ethics. If you look at the things that happened at Abu Ghraib, we used to tell my commander, I used to tell people, hey, come home with a story. Everyone's going to come home with a story. Come home with a story that you can tell your grandkids. Let's come home with a story you can be proud of. Don't go down the road. Because it's a temptation, a power that's at work, and we had enemy prisoners that we kept, and I would go out and make sure that they were taken care of, and my kids were doing the right thing. They were taking care of these guys, even though they were enemy. Killing overrides that civilian moral value. Handling human remains is a major factor. It overrides the revulsion and the grief that can happen. Betrayal by authorities, soldiers who are ordered to do things that they may think is unethical. Things that happen with, I had one person say, you know, going to Iraq, I was okay. I got there and I looked around and everything was run by Halliburton. And I said, well, so? And he said, who owned Halliburton? Dick Cheney. And he's like, he's like, it just rubbed me wrong. Here I am going to war and Halliburton and just making money. I was like, oh, I guess, yeah, I never thought about that, but he felt that disrupted his trust in the whole system. Mm-hmm. And then doubt and uncertainty about the goals or the mission disrupts that inner confidence. And you go back to, just betrayal of authorities. My dad in his Vietnam experience can go on a rant about the betrayal that he felt and then coming back. Not that he wasn't there and he was fine doing the mission. It's that coming back from and then the way the narrative on his deployment, his war changed, and very quickly the way the narrative changed.
Will we be at on that from how long back?
No.
We call all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
My brother-in-law was telling me he was spent on the San Francisco airport.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even in Vietnam. He was.
You just had a uniform on?
Taiwan, yeah. He was in Taiwan. But because he was a military person,
yeah.
He was a baby killer, he was a rapist, and he was, he said people were spitting on him, they were trying to change
Right. Claims,
and he's never gotten over that. And that's what, 30 years now? Almost 40?
Yeah.
And he still deals with that every day, but people still think of him as a killer. He said, all I did is put on headphones and listen to what's going on down Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Right.
But people don't see it that way. I've got another question. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, sure.
On the news today, and there are several instances, I'm sure you know more about them than I do. Military officers are being tried for murder who killed enemy combatants who were trying to kill them. One of them, we caught some Green Beret officer, killed a bomb maker who shot at him, but he killed him without permission from authority, but yet he was the Green Beret commander. So he's being tried in a military court. Is that a disruption of authority? Betrayal? I would think so.
Yes.
You do your job, and all of a sudden you come back and you're being tried as a murderer. Mm-hmm. You followed their instructions. You did what you were trained to do. And yet, the political situation says you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You like Halliburton. You know, you've got military leaders were overridden by civilian contractors.
Yeah. Well, and that's where what I've seen is the rules of engagement that they are given and the way that that changes, you know, depending on the politics of it. When we were there, I would say that it was tight. I think it has since changed. We had the authority of, hey, if you don't have to wait for them to shoot at you.
If you
see them pointing at, you know, raising a gun towards you, you have permission to shoot first. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, Dad being a fire pilot, they had to have positive confirmation. They, you know, had to wait for them to be fired upon. You know, all of these little, the way that rule of engagement was, the way it has changed since, and it may be that that's what the issue is. Is the way that rule had changed where he needed to have permission to make that.
But they're asking men and women to go into combat and yes. do a job when they do their job because of the political situation. Now they're
right.
being put in double jeopardy.
Right. Right. And that would be that, you know, so that you can tell you we distrust our authorities.
Part of the reason that I have absolutely no trust or respect for our federal government.
That's what happens.
Well, then part of that is that the soldiers coming back now are relating what has happened. Whereas in previous generations, you know, there was reluctance. The vets coming home from World War II were very reticent about talking about what happened. So is that healthier that they can talk about it, or is it not?
I think if you go back to World War II era, because that's when the VFWs, that's when those were kind of established.
Okay. Okay.
And so you have what is it, the 20% of the population that was in uniform
yeah.
in 1945? Had a whole culture of understanding
okay.
the military service of combat of all of this. And in fact, if you look at the 1950s and 60s, you had hysterical shows making fun of military service. McHale's Navy, Gomer Pyle, all of that, Hogan's Heroes. It was a collective experience that I think that generation shared. Whereas here it's less than 1% of the population that's doing military service. Whereas a generation ago, you had just a collective group that understood military service.
Yeah.
I think so you have that where this generation's coming back saying, please understand me. Why don't you understand me? Please understand me. Whereas, you know, you could have guys working in a garage and all four of them had been to war, and now you've got this kid who doesn't know where his place is mm-hmm. and is just trying to explain himself. Yes.
Yeah.
I think in our society, I think especially in our cultural context here, we're very aware of, I mean, this is Military USA, we're aware of PTSD, but, and I know that, I mean, in the military, people are aware of PTSD, but how open, if you're an active service person, do you actually share with others that, hey, I'm struggling with this? Like, is it something that, like, is it openly shared, or do you actually feel shame and try to conceal it from your other colleagues?
I would say that I'm probably not the right person to ask because people come to me with, as the chaplain, they come to me with these kinds of issues. Maybe
there are some people that are ashamed and won't talk about it. And there's groups of people, and sometimes you can kind of know. But for the most part, it's become very socially acceptable through the military where I've been to talk about it. We would stop whatever we were doing and tell war stories for an hour or so, or share and talk to people. And part of it was done intentionally to tell the younger people, hey, it's okay, go get help, we're here for you, talk about it, take care of yourself. And some of it was just to help us, because I have a great uncle, he was a POW in World War II, and he never talked about anything for years. he started to after his fifth wife left him. And he said it was like I was carrying around all these boulders. And every time I tell my story, I take a boulder off of myself. And I give someone else my boulder. And to them, it's a little pebble of knowledge that doesn't weigh anything to them and makes them smarter. But it makes me feel so much better. And I think that's where the VFW and American Legion and all that came into help. You could shut the doors and tell people whatever you wanted. Nobody thought anything about it.
Nobody judged you.
Yeah, you weren't judged for it. You weren't going to be turned in or whatever.
Well, my dad was in South Pacific the first year of the war, flying in Australia. That Philippines fell in long way to the Philippines. And he was a navigator. After his missions, he came back here. He said, you know, the difference between World War II and basically after that, when they came back from World War II, they were heroes. Everybody was a hero. They were in uniform. Now we've got, like you said, people that call them baby killers and murderers and rapists. Those, I got no use for those people whatsoever. Because the only reason they got the right to say what they're saying is because somebody went to war for them. And really, I think we've gone so far against our own military and allowed these people to get away with it and gotten liberal. I think that's a lot of the problem because, you know, you don't come back with as a hero and then work through these things. You feel bad to start with. And then...
Yeah, and I think the shift from Vietnam to present... has changed. I think in that era, everyone between the age of 18 and 22 had a vested interest in U.S. foreign policy because there was a draft, and you could be told, don't care, go. And whereas now, it's an all-volunteer force for the last 30 years, and there's a level of professionalism in soldiering that's different. But I think because there are so few who are in uniform right now, that the experience I had getting off the airplane in Maine, Bangor, Maine, and these wonderful people in Bangor, Maine come out to greet you, and they hand you cell phones, and they tell you to call your wife because you're back in country, welcome home. And I know my dad didn't get that experience because he went through San Francisco. When he returned from Vietnam, and it was totally different. And so I think that has helped, but I don't know if they're still doing that. I think they still do. If they know a troop flight is coming in from Afghanistan, I think the town of Bangor still shows up for them.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, but that's a totally different experience than 1968.
Right. I noticed a big shift after 9/11. Before 9/11, there was still a lot of that anti-military sentiment throughout the country. But after 9/11, and you know, we went to Afghanistan and all that, I did see among the general population a shift. It unfortunately hasn't swung all the way back to post-World War II, where they were heralded as heroes, which I believe it should be. I don't think it's ever swung back that far, but. It's probably more towards the middle than it was.
It is. I would say it shifted more towards the middle than it was back then.
We've still got people that protest on a soldier's burial. They'll be out there across the street and holding up signs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, quick question.
Yes.
My ex-husband has very severe PTSD. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got a safe zone around his house. He never leaves it. They've been married for 13 years. I've seen him twice. How does that affect the kids? They have two boys, so their youngest boy is always with my aunt. They're always coming to family functions, etc. Mm-hmm. Whereas the oldest boy is closer to his dad, so he takes on more of those characteristics. He prefers to not be quite around people. You know, too much noise, overwhelm. What kind of statistics are there on that?
I have not seen that statistic. I think that, though, just behaviorally, kids tend to emulate their parents, especially as younger kids will try to emulate dad. And that's, you know, that's really interesting. I've not seen any studies on that, but I'm sure somebody's probably looked at it. But I can see where you can end up having an equally dysfunctional child because you're being raised, I mean, well, there you go, normal families. Dysfunctional families tend to generate dysfunctional families.
That's
I've not seen any research on that. That's really interesting, though. So, remember, moral injury is a disruption of an individual's confidence or expectation about their own moral behavior or somebody else's capability to be just and ethical and moral. And so we see these complex feelings start to and they start to work in clusters. But shame is really where it comes in. With moral injury versus like PTSD. PTSD is a fear-based. Something bad has happened to you, and your amygdala is overriding the system. Whereas moral injury is, you know, go to that UAB kid who's watching the screen all day, and then go into this kid's soccer game.
Yeah.
That's where moral injury tends to occur without any traumatic event. And that's going to generate some of these feelings, I think, that we have to watch out for. And I think in many ways, that soul injury, that old sage's definition, where we've injured the soul, is what I think is going on when we see this.